मिरांधस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. So if we were to go on the street and we were to ask the average person, who is God? How would you define what is God? The typical person would give us a reply. Across the world, in different religions, different traditions, they would typically say something like, God is the creator. If that person is a Hindu, they would say God is creator, maintainer, and destroyer. If we press them a little further, they might say that God is great, God is love, God is mercy. They might identify God as all-powerful or omnipresent. And all of these things are, of course, very true. The great philosopher Aristotle in ancient Greece, he said that he defined God as the unmoved mover, the one who moves all beings, but himself is not moved. He's not pushed by anything. So in Sanskrit, this is called Anadi Adi. Anadir Adir Govinda. That the Lord is the origin. He's unmoved, but Adi, he's the mover. He's moving everyone else. And even the Upanishads, the Vedanta Sutra, they say very clearly, Janmadyasya Yataha, he from whom everything comes. Everything is born, that is Brahman. That is the absolute truth. So these definitions of God that we find in all the world's religions, including Hinduism, are not at all false. They're very true and they're very correct. That God is the cause of creation. God is the most merciful one. God is all of these things, the compassionate. But there is a question from this that only the Vaishnavas ask, which is, if we were to raise the question, what is God doing when he is not concerned with us? Who is he in himself? Then what would we answer? You see, every definition that people give, God is cause of all causes, God is the unmoved mover, God is the compassionate one, God is the creator, Srishtikarta. Every definition, Jagadish, right? Om Jai Jagadisha Hare. Every definition that people give is always in relation to his usefulness to us. He's creator. Well, who's creator? My creator. He's compassionate. To who? Well, to me. He is love. Who does he love? The implied object of love is myself. There's always the focuses on God's usefulness to me. Like Prabhupada always says, man proposes and God disposes. But what about that situation if we were to think of God when he is on his own, when he's not concerned with us? What about that? In every child's life, there comes a point where the child realizes that the parents have a life beyond them. When the children are small, then for them, the parent, the teacher, the only existence of the parent is in relation to them. If the parents aren't there at some moment that the child needs them because they're hungry or something, then the response from the children is always one of not just upset, but indignation. How dare you be? I remember when my son was very small, the older one, Chaitanya, when he woke up, he expected that we will be there right next to his bed. And if we are not there, and God forbid, should he crawl out of bed and see us in some other room, then immediately he would start crying that I've been abandoned, no one loves me, I'm not cared for. How dare you? How dare you not there when I needed you? So this is the world, and I remember myself as a child thinking about my teachers and not realizing that after they leave the classroom, they've got another life that has nothing to do with the job that they're playing in regard to teaching me. But every parent hopes that at some point in the child's growth, in their maturity, they come to this point where they come to recognize that it's a two-way relationship. That just as the child needs the parent, so the parents also depend on the child for that reciprocation of love. So, most of the time in the world's religions, including our own, the attitude towards God is one of childish behavior, of immaturity. He is there for me, and I needed him today, and he wasn't there. I asked him for something, no? I needed his support, and where were you? But the Vaishnava Acharyas, they ask the question, what is the Lord concerned with when he is not concerned with me? When he is spending his time on his own, what is he doing with all of his time? And that question, they answer in the simplest and most beautiful way possible. They say that with his time, the Lord, God, the all-powerful one, what does he do when he's not concerned with us? He simply plays. That's it. He's playing. The word lila in Sanskrit just means play. And what else would he do but play? If I were to ask you the definition of what is play and what is work, suppose I were to give you an example and say, painting. Is painting work or is it play? How would you answer? It depends. Yeah. If you get a painter who goes to his job every day and paints, then he looks forward to coming home, taking a shower, and getting rid of the paintbrush. It's work. But the same person who goes to the office and spends his day programming computers, comes home, looks forward to sitting down with the paintbrush and painting, right? For play, for joy. The activity is exactly the same. But what is the difference? In one, he has to do it. He must do it. He's forced to do it out of necessity, under the command of someone else. Paint this, get this done by this time, and you must do it because you're getting a salary to support your family. In the other one, he's doing it out of free will, from choice. Now tell me, what is it that God must do in this world, that he is forced to do as a result of necessity? Does he need the money? Does he need the education? He doesn't need any of that. Therefore, it follows that everything he does is only because he wants to do it, out of his free volition. And therefore, everything he does is play, is lila. Now, we might say, well, what about the desire, the need to have fun, to be happy? Maybe this is a need. You see, children have this need. We have this need as adults. I have to plan my annual vacation. Why? Because I have to be happy. I have to have fun. This is important. What will I put on Facebook if I don't have my holiday? Right? So I must. So maybe there's a need inside, a hole I'm trying to fill. So, is God like that? Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushana, he says, no, this is not the nature of God's lila. He says, Krishna's play is not out of a necessity to be happy because he is already completely self-satisfied. He's completely santushta. He's satisfied. So, what is his lila then? If it's not a need for some fun or for satisfaction. He says, lila is simply the natural outpouring of the Lord's own joy, his own inner joy. It's the external manifestation of what is already inside. So in our case, play is the attempt to take what is outside and bring it into our lives to fill a hole because something is absent, something is missing. My life is drab and every day is the same thing. So I need to change. I need to add some spice. But for Krishna, it's not taking what is outside and putting it inside, but rather it's taking what is inside and it spills forth naturally. And Baladev Vidyabhushan gives the wonderful example. He says, it is like when a person who has everything in this world, who's healthy and satisfied, wakes up in the morning and for no reason starts to sing and dance. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. It happens rarely in our life. But sometimes you wake up in the morning and you just want to sing. Some nice melody of Mahamantra comes out and no one is there in the room, or maybe you're in the shower. The shower is probably the most likely place. We sing and we clean ourselves. So one might say, what is the object of that singing? Why are you doing it? Are you trying to gain something? No, it's just there's some joy in the heart. It's coming out. It's spilling forth. So Leela is the natural overflowing of God's own nature, spilling forth like a cup that overflows with milk. Now, that Leela, Ananda that is present in the Lord's heart, the Upanishads, they say again and again that this is the ultimate definition of who God is, of where He's at. Yes, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, that the absolute truth is Satyam, He's true, He's Jnanam, knowledge, He's Anantam, He's unlimited. But beyond all of that, ultimately, Anandam Brahma, Anandaveva Kalvimani Bhutani Jayante Yena Jatani Jivanti Tat Prayanti Abhisham Vishanti Tad Vijignyasasva Tad Brahmeti Anandam Brahma. That Brahman is Ananda. From Ananda, all things are born. Because of Ananda, or the desire for that joy, they live. And into Ananda, they return again. That Ananda, that bliss is Brahman. That's the absolute truth. But then the Vaishnava Acharyas ask yet another question. They say, okay, the nature of the Lord is Ananda, is bliss. It's Leela, it's play, that it's a product of His own joy. But that Ananda, that joy, that bliss, how can it be experienced? If you want to experience that Ananda, that joy, if you want to have that play, you want to have Leela, then what do you need in order to play? What is the most important ingredient? And they say, yes, you need someone else. You need a companion. And therefore, the Upanishads already, they point out that that original absolute truth, Sadeva Somya Idam Agra Asit, Chandogya Upanishad said, Sat Eva Somya Idam Agra Asit. In the beginning, Agra, Sat Eva, there was only Sat, only Brahman. No one else, nothing else. But then, what happened? Tadaikshata, he thought, Bahusyam Prajayaya, let me become many. Let me propagate myself. Let me multiply myself. Why? Because being alone, the Upanishads say, is not at all joyful. Boring. Unpleasant. Even those who give up the world must then find others who have given up the world and live with them. Isn't it? This is why brahmachari, sannyasis, we live together in community. It's okay, we give up the world. But then, we still need that company, that companionship with others. Alone, there is no joy, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says. So for Leela, we need rasa. We need relationship. And therefore, Srila Rupa Goswami, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, therefore defines Lord Krishna as Akhila Rasamrita Murti, one who is the complete embodiment of all rasa, of all relationships that are present. This concept of lila combined with rasa is the unique contribution of the Vaishnava traditions and specifically of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. One can study all the world's religions and they have many wonderful things to say about the nature of God and how humanity should live. But this special quality of knowing God as He is on His own, not in relation to us, but by His own nature, as Lila Purushottam, as the one who is completely given to playing. And then, with that play, we re-enter that picture as His associates, as His servants. You see, initially, to define the Lord as Lila Purushottam, we had to remove the world. We had to think, what is God when He's not dealing with us? So we said He's play. He is the one who is always playing. But then for play, we must reintroduce ourselves again. Because to play, the Lord needs us. He cannot play alone. And this is why He multiplies Himself into all the different living entities, so that He may relate to them. And in studying the world's religions, I have not found yet a concept so beautiful and so perfectly formulated as this idea of lila combined with rasa. It's beautiful, it's wonderful, and it's distinctly Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's contribution. But it doesn't end there. Mahaprabhu pushes it yet further. He says, okay, the Lord's nature is to play, and to play He needs other living beings. And with other living beings, He has these relationships called rasa. But then He says, what kind of relationships are we talking about? The average relationships that the Lord has with the world tend to be focused primarily on an attitude of reverence born of appreciation for God's majesty and His power. And that is, no doubt, a valid relationship with the Lord. But Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, let's push it further. Me being the servant of God is still seeing God in my terms. He is the master and I am the servant. Let's keep our focus on Him and ask the question, what kind of relationship would He want? Not what kind of relationship do I want with God? What are my expectations in the relationship? But what are Krishna's expectations in the relationship? And Krishna, He is not interested in that awe and reverence relationship. He's interested in a relationship where that affection is unmarred by any kind of distance. The intimacy is born of a love that comes, that is free of that sense of awe and reverence. And so, then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu focuses this concept of God, right, anadir adir, sarvakarana karanam, to lila purushottam, to akhila rasamrita murti, to finally, that akhila rasamrita murti, the one we want to worship, is specifically Vrajesha Tanaya. He's the son of the king of Braj. This is very, very important, because note that we don't worship the king of Braj. We don't call Krishna the king of Braj. Radharani we call the queen of Vrindavan, the queen of Braj. But Krishna not the king of Braj. He's the son of the king of Braj. Means He has been divested of all His power, all His rights, all His majesty. Everything has been removed from Him. he's left 100% dependent and vulnerable on his king, on his father, on his mother, and on his friends. And ultimately, on the gopis. And completely controlled by that love. Sometimes people argue, they say, how is it that God is all powerful? He's all majestic, he's unknowable, he's inconceivable, and yet you turn him into a human-like little boy. Isn't this a travesty to the nature of God? But we might turn that question around, upside down, and say, what is more inconceivable? For the all-powerful, let's say that there is a being who is all-powerful, omnipresent, omniscient, who knows everything. Now, what is more inconceivable? For that person to be a power that pervades this creation, to be an old man in the sky with a thunderbolt in his hand? Or is it more inconceivable for that all-powerful, immeasurable, all-pervading entity to come in the package of a little small boy who you could easily confuse for any other child? Which is more inconceivable? The second, right? For big things to come in big packages, that's expected. But for big things to come in small and sweet packages, that's very amazing. I remember one time I was in Delhi, in our Glory of India temple there. And it was Janmashtami day. And, you know, always these the dignitaries are always coming there. And that particular year, there was the Chief Minister of Delhi coming. And I think it was the Prime Minister coming of India that same year. Maybe it was someone else at the top level. Here's the funny thing. First, the chief minister came, and when he arrived, there was like this whole security display. People with guns and these military people, big long guns. They had their finger on the trigger and their hand over here, and literally they were climbing on different pillars of the temple and pointing down, and this whole, it's like, you know, really Aishwarya to the max. And then the Prime Minister came, and he was dressed in simple pajama kurta, folding his hands, and there was no security to be found anywhere. I'm sure it was there, no doubt. I mean, how is it possible that it wasn't there? But the point is, the one who is lesser has a need to display that they are greater. Isn't it? I'm a little guy, so I have to make sure everyone knows. Do you know I'm professor? Do you know? I'm PhD. But someone who is actually great, they don't have to prove themselves to anyone. They walk into a room and everyone is automatically, they know, this is Prime Minister. So this display of power and opulence, this is not a sign of God. It is a sign of God. But if this was all there was, it would be a sign of God's weakness, his insecurity, that he has to always make a show. See, I'm God. Anytime I descend, I come from heaven. There's a break in the clouds. The big voice comes. Everyone trembles. Okay, he does that sometimes. But isn't it greater? Isn't it more confident, more secure? When the Lord is so confident about who he is, that he can come as a little boy, as a child, and he can beg for some butter from the gopis. And he can show his fear and his confusion when Mother Yashoda is chasing him with a stick. That shows his confidence. That shows that he actually has nothing to lose. He's happy to give up everything to his mother because ultimately he cannot lose anything. It's that Vrajesha Tanaya, that son of Maharaj Nanda, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, he is our worshipable Lord. He is the one whom we worship. But Mahaprabhu does not stop even there. He says, if the goal is to love that little boy as he is in a vulnerable state, as he is small in a sweet package, if that's our goal, then when is that love the greatest? When he is in our lap with us, or when he is absent from us? He says, of the two, the love in absence is much deeper. It's much greater. It is more intense. Nothing reminds the parents how much they love their children than the first time the children go somewhere without them. Then it's, oh my God, I can't think of anything. What are they doing? Why are they doing? Are they okay? It's much greater. When they're with you, then it's like, chalo, baitho kya? What are you doing? Come on, get up. It's, oh, headache, such a headache, the kids. The minute they're gone, all the love comes pouring out. The focus becomes more intense. It becomes stronger. So he says, okay, if the goal is to love him with his sweetness, then that sweetness, that remembrance, the intensity of that love is greater in separation than it is in union. And so therefore Mahaprabhu focuses on viraha bhakti, that love in separation from Krishna, as the highest way of worshipping Rajesha Tanaya, the son of Maharaj Nanda, the abode of sweetness, not of majesty, who is the abode of all rasas, of relationships, the supreme abode of all lila, lila purushottam. You see, each step focuses more and more from God who is the cause of all causes, to God who is the playful one, to God who is the abode of all relationships, to the best of those relationships which are marked by sweetness, not by majesty, to the most intense of those sweet relationships, namely those in separation from the Lord. And that point is where Mahaprabhu brings us and tells us this is how to love Krishna. Ashlishyava padaratam pinashtuma adarshanan marmahatam karotuva. That is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's contribution, that he condenses, he intensifies, he narrows down, he points us to that point which is the rarest of all rare things, that is the sweetest of all sweet things, that no one else but Mahaprabhu has given, this love in separation as done by the residents of Vrindavan. And that in itself would be something extraordinary. But there's still more. What makes Mahaprabhu so amazingly special is that he takes that highly condensed, intensified, rarest, sweetest of all things, and then he turns it around and gives it freely to everyone. He hands it out. Therefore, Prabhupada is quoting here, Namo Mahavadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate, that he's the most munificent, the most merciful, that he comes at the worst possible time in this universe's cycles. He preaches to the worst possible people in the worst possible circumstances and decides to give the best possible gift. That is unmatched in the history of the world. You know, historians, scholars of world religions, they say that there are two time periods in the history of the world that globally are very, very significant. One is called the Axial Age, 2,500 years ago. All over the world, amazing things were happening. 2,500 years ago in China, there was Well, let's start with India first. Here in India, 2,500 years ago, according to historians, Lord Buddha was there, 500 BCE. And Lord Mahavira was there. Brand new forms of religious thinking, deep meditation, practices, orders of monks, contemplation, meditation, all of this was happening 2,500 years ago. And it changed the course of the world's history. If you see after that, Emperor Ashoka, 300 BC, and he spread Buddhism all over India. And he sent his son as a monk to Sri Lanka to preach. And from Sri Lanka, it went to Thailand and to Cambodia and Southeast Asia. And then to China, Japan and Korea, Tibet. The world was changed. In China, 2,500 years ago, the great sage Lao Tzu was speaking, the Tao Te Ching, a great Chinese classic. Similar principles of understanding our spiritual nature, meditating, and so on. Confucius also, Kung Fu Tzu, he wrote his Analects, teachings that have essentially done for China what the Upanishads have done for India. This is the time period that scholars say that the Upanishads were written down on paper. We date it earlier, but anyway, they say that this is the point at which the Upanishads were also written on paper. The oral tradition of learning them orally, much older, but when they were written down. If you go to the Middle East, around this time, the great Hebrew prophets were speaking the vision of God as recorded in the Old Testament. The whole world was at a time of great religious ferment, where this knowledge of the spirit soul, of the fact that there is something greater, the necessity of detachment, was being taught by everyone all over the world. That was the first period, Axial Age, 2,500 years ago. But the next period that is marked as a time of great religious change and ferment is 500 years ago. 500 years ago, what was happening around the world? A time of great change. In Europe, the Protestant Reformation was happening. The thousands of year old church, the Catholic Church, was being rejected in favor of a new religion where every human being had the opportunity to have a direct and personal relationship with God. It was at this time that the printing press was invented, allowing the Bible and so many other sacred books to be printed and distributed widely. This was the time when people started translating the Bible for the first time into languages that people could actually speak, like German, French, and Italian, instead of just Latin, which no one could. This was the time when Europeans were first starting to explore outside the boundaries of their home, sending ships sailing in different directions, looking for India, looking for spices, looking for wisdom in the East. And in India, what was happening? The great movement of the Bhakti Renaissance was taking place. All these poets and saints like Mirabai and Surdas and Eknath and so many others, Tukaram, they're all around the same time period. What are they doing? They're teaching the great Reformation here, that every human being has the potential to have a direct relationship with the Lord. You don't have to go through the Brahmin priest to do the rituals for you. Just chant his name. You can have a direct contact with him. And what do they do with the scriptures? They began to translate them, to speak them in people's own languages. Did Sant Tukaram sing in Sanskrit? No. Did Surdas sing in Sanskrit? No. Did Kabir preach in Sanskrit? No. They spoke in the languages of the people themselves. It was in this time period, just before the birth of the modern era. This is called early modernity. Modernity, the modern world, is just about to arrive. The world is just about to explode 500 years ago with the scourge of colonialism, where people all will travel the world raping and pillaging and conquering other people, exploiting them for their resources. When huge empires will begin to stand and missionary work will happen. When industrialization is about to be born, where factories will come and take people from the farms and put them on assembly lines, killing their souls and destroying their bodies. That industrial revolution. At that moment, at that cusp in history, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appears. He appears just before this world is about to go to hell. This is what I mean when I say the worst possible time he comes. Because he knows, the Lord knows, that from this point on, Kali Yuga, yes, started 5,000 years ago with Krishna's departure, no doubt. But still, there was some semblance of culture. But starting 500 years ago, at this point, everything, human beings, the humanity's very soul is going to be crushed by this industrialization, by this capitalism, by this impersonalization. And it is at this point that human beings need the easiest, most sublime, simplest, and sweetest form of relief they can find, which is the chanting of Krishna's holy names. And so he comes at this moment to give this very special gift. So if we look at Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the context of his theology, or if we look at him in the context of history, we find that one way or the other, Mahaprabhu is unique. He is special. He is extraordinary. And we are lucky enough to be direct spiritual descendants of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We're just a few generations from his time. It's not much. A few generations back is Baladev Vidyabhushan Vishwanath Chakravarti. That's 1800s. That far back, most Indian families can remember who was born and what are their names, and they have records for this kind of thing. It's not very, you can go to Jagannath Puri and the Panda will tell you. 200 years ago, this relative came to visit Jagannath. And just a couple hundred years before that, Mahaprabhu was there. Very accessible, very immediate. We know exactly what was happening in India at that time. Exactly. Sri Krishna, we can say, we're not exactly sure. We know from Bhagavatam things were like this, but Mahaprabhu, you can read the history books, you can tell exactly what was happening in India. The caste system was driving Hinduism into the ground. Industrialization was happening. Europeans had already set their sights on India. The Muslim empires were here. We know exactly what was going on. And in that arena, right here, within our reach, Mahaprabhu was born. He appeared. And we can claim to be his descendants. We are in that parampara. How fortunate we are. How fortunate we are. So I will stop there and see if anyone has any questions or comments that they'd like to raise just for a couple of minutes. Yes, Prabhu?
What is our understanding? What is the actually oldest written text that we accept?
So what we accept as the oldest written text and the scholars accept is more or less the same. It's just the chronology. So the scholars say that the oldest written text in Sanskrit is the Rig Veda, or the four Vedic Samhitas, Rig, Yajur, Atharva, and Sama. And we say more or less the same thing, except scholars put them at different points in history in terms of their creation, their composition. And we say that they were all written by the same person, but the chronology is the same. what came first? The Vedas. Those were not actually composed by Vyasadeva. Those are eternal. He simply writes them down and splits them up. And then after that, we say after Vyasadeva does that, then he works on the Upanishads and the Vedanta Sutra in order to help us understand the Upanishads. Scholars put it in the same chronology. And after the Upanishads and Vedanta Sutra, what comes next? He writes Mahabharata. For all those people who can't read Upanishads because of social restrictions and Sanskrit knowledge necessary, the Vedas and the Upanishads. Then come Mahabharata. Scholars do exactly the same thing. And after he does the Mahabharata and the Puranas and all of that, and he's totally dissatisfied, then what does he write? Bhagavatam. And that's the order in which the scholars put it. Except we say this all happened within the lifetime of Vyasadeva, 5,000 years ago. And they say, no, it happened from 5,000 years ago to about 1,200 years ago. So that's the difference. The time scale is different. The chronology, the order is more or less the same. And ultimately speaking, honestly, it doesn't matter so much to us, one way or the other. You see, for us, the fact that X comes before Y, or A comes before B, is less important. Because for us, this concern with time being chick, 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 it's one after the other, is a concern that is born particularly with a vision of time that is linear. Has a start and it has a finish. There's the beginning of time and there's the apocalypse coming at the end. And for that, you need to know what comes before and what comes after. In the Vedic traditions, what comes exactly before and what comes exactly after? Not so important. Yes, the important thing is Krishna was there. He appeared on earth. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared. What exactly order or how, who came when, what the time frame is, less important. It's not that it's not important, it's less important. Why? Because time is circular, it's cyclical. So you have, you know, the red Varaha and you have the white Varaha, yes? And so the Acharyas, they say, not so much of a problem, this is just Kalpa Bheda, different Kalpas. The Lord comes sometimes this, sometimes. Anytime there's a contradiction in the sequence or in the order, or two different things are described of the same avatar, or the same point in history, the acharyas say, no problem, this happened like this in this kalpa, this age, and the previous kalpa, it happened like that. So we can accommodate everything. Why? Because time is cyclical. So what comes before and what comes after in a circle? Tell me. You draw a circle, does this point come before this, or does it come after this point? It depends where you are in the circle. Right? So we should not get too hung up on the question of dating. The point is, this is reality. It's history. It happened. We don't say it's mythology. Krishna appeared. All of these, this happened. But the dating question is, it's not so, not such a big deal. There's a couple places where Prabhupada even he lets the Aryan invasion theory also go. He says, yeah, yeah. And he talks about it as if it's given fact. At other places, he rejects it. It's not such a crucial thing, you know, exactly where, at what point it entered, it came. Not so big. Other questions, comments anyone has? Okay, thank you all so much for your attention. I hope you have a very, very wonderful Gaur Purnima festival. I just wanted to say I'm back this particular visit because I've brought a group of my students here from Utah State University. There's a group of 20 students and faculty who have come from my university in the United States. So for the next few days, I'm here for about 4 or 5 days. You'll have to forgive me. You're going to see me in my Professor Vesha. So pant and shirt and everything. If you see me, then please still recognize me as your servant. the same person, but sometimes the dress has to be changed so that we can properly... yeah. Vasansi jirnani yathavihaya. So thank you all so much for your attention. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.